Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a number of items on our agenda today, and let's see, we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 252. And counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 252 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The bill requires that multiple convictions during a single judicial proceeding be counted only once for the purpose of determining a person's criminal history. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this would basically overturn the 1993 Supreme Court case of State v. Buchholz.
All righty. So I had a special request that the prosecutors wanted to go first and last, just like a good but I think I'm going to let the proponents go first. So Mark Blackman, Gail Meyer, and Jess Barton, please come forward. Hey, it's Monday morning. Got to start with a laugh.
Plastic covers of coffee table. Did you get them today?
You, is yours by chance a 2009 plastic cover?
2008.
I'm sorry. We have both the 2008 plastic laminate, and committee members, I've already been told that we can borrow the 2008s, but we do have to give them back. The one that's not laminated, which is the 2009, will be for ours to keep for future use in the committee.
Done. No, we don't want to be held accountable.
Well, there's actually on the back something that you're going to need to see when we get in as part of the presentation. Yeah. Gail, whoever's going to start off.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pozanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I actually feel like I should start this session out with a little bit of an apology, and that I haven't been able to circle around to every member and sort of introduce them to the substance of what we're discussing here in this bill. I will acknowledge readily that it's complicated, and even for practitioners it can be complicated. So we hope to introduce it to you slowly, and I'm certainly going to be available for questions as we go. So with respect to the grid, which you all have now, and I'm pleased to see that, if you'll recall, last week we had that bill with eluding, attempting to elude and fleeing, and that was where we were elevating along the vertical axis because it was relating to the crime seriousness rating of a crime.
This bill relates to the horizontal
axis going from the I block, which is for someone who has no prior criminal history whatsoever, and how do you calculate to the left all the way up to A? How is it that you count an offender's prior criminal history? With respect to Senate Bill 252, we also want to flag to the committee that we're really talking about concepts here. Some of the language as originally written in this bill is unduly cumbersome. We acknowledge that, and we want to be readily available to clarify it, clean it up, make it more simple. There's three things that I hope the committee will walk away from this presentation. Number one, what we're suggesting that we do here in this bill would basically restore the practice to the way it originally was when the guidelines were initially enacted in 1989. The interpretation we're asking the committee to return to is the one that was initially employed when the guidelines were first enacted. The interpretation we're asking you to go back to is one that's very similar to what's employed by the federal system. And Mr. Blackman, to my right here, will be able to explain to you what goes on in the federal system and how they accommodate for a criminal history that may or may not over or under represent exactly the conduct of the accused. And then the third thing we'd like the committee to walk away from is an understanding that this simple adjustment that we're suggesting here can save millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, depending on how far you go out, but the cost fiscal impact here is substantial. The bill is divided into four sections. As I indicated already, we readily acknowledge that this should be refined with some of its language. We're suggesting that subsection 4 not be worked at all. We just suggest that it be deleted in its entirety because it relates to burden of proof, and I think that there's challenges to that right now in the judicial system, and perhaps that's exactly where it should stay. But as to subsection 1, what subsection 1 deals with is when an offender's before the court and is being sentenced on multiple convictions. How should the court consider those multiple convictions? The way it is considered right now under the Buchholz decision is that if an offender is before the court on, let's say, three counts of pleas of guilty, on the very first sentence, the court would analyze the offender as being in the I block with having no prior criminal conviction, but then on the very second plea, right before the judge at the very same time, he would use the conviction on that very first plea to advance the offender down the horizontal scale on the second plea. And again, on if he was sentencing on the third count, he would use the convictions on the first and the second count to advance further down the scale to sentence him on the third count. And so our analysis would be, in most judicial proceedings, to keep him, the offender in the same criminal history score for all of those convictions, all those counts, in one judicial proceeding. Subsection 2 deals when there's multiple prior convictions, an offender's past, he's been sentenced for them, new crimes, now that offender's in front of the judge again, how do you calculate those convictions that occurred in the past? Subsection 3 deals with the imposition of consecutive sentencing. So hopefully we can take this through you slowly in a way that you'll understand. Let's see, who's going next? You're going next. Mark Blackman's going to go next. Mark is a practitioner in Portland. He's been in private practice for...
too long.
Many long years. Formerly a federal U.S. attorney and does practice in federal court. He'll be explaining some of what the bill does and correlating it to the practice of federal court. And then Jess Barton here, to my left, will be giving a PowerPoint presentation on some of the probable fiscal impact from these changes.
So before we go into this, give me a ballpark about how much time you think the complete panel is going to need for presentation so I can schedule or make sure we're on schedule.
Mr. Chairman, I think my part should be less than 5 minutes, maybe three.
Okay. And Jess?
Mr. Chairman, probably about 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, let's go for it.
All right. I did prepare some written testimony, which I think will be handed out to you, and I don't want to repeat what's already in writing, but basically, philosophically or jurisprudentially, however you want to put it, the purpose of 252 and what it would accomplish is to return the concept of prior criminal history to what it has always been recognized by in the court system and initially under the guidelines until the Supreme Court decided Buchholz and Miller in 93, which is one's criminal history is based on whether one has been before the court before and been sanctioned and learned or not learned one's lesson. So that if one had been previously convicted of a crime and punished and ends up before the court again, that person is viewed as a recidivist. That person is viewed as someone who didn't learn their lesson, that is someone who should be punished more harshly than the person who is coming before the court for the first time. That is what lawyers call the single judicial proceeding concept. And what this bill attempts to do is return the single judicial proceeding concept to the concept or application or determination of criminal history. Under the current system, as the Supreme Court of Oregon has interpreted the guidelines and the rules regarding criminal history, a person before the court for the first time on a multiple count charge is sentenced on the last charge of conviction as if that person had been before the court and sentenced each time for each count that preceded that, as Gail just explained. The result is that a person before the court for the first time on a five count indictment who is being sanctioned for all five counts, which would typically be the case of someone who's gone to trial, is treated for criminal history purposes on count five exactly the same as the person who's before the court for the fifth time, having been prosecuted and sentenced, sanctioned four previous times for conduct, but charged in only one count indictments. Because today, the way history is computed is based on how many convictions of record a person has.
Not whether they were part of the single conviction proceeding,
not whether the person had been sanctioned separately and didn't learn their lesson. So this really does return to the idea that there's a major distinction, and I quote in my written materials from the introductory language of the Sentencing Commission from the federal system, which talks about recidivism being a major purpose for punishment, and that the system, judicial system, should treat more harshly people who have been sentenced in the past and not learned their lesson. What this bill does is modeled on how the federal system treats criminal history. And it looks at, and I've attached as exhibits, the rules for computing criminal history in the federal system. It looks at, has the person received a sanction in the past? And it actually allocates, depending on the seriousness of the sanction, how many points that earns the person for criminal history. And so someone who has been before the court before and sentenced and incarcerated and ends up coming before the court again, having reoffended, is treated differently, regardless of the number of counts involved, than the person who's before the court for the first time. And I think anyone who studies human nature at all understands there's a big difference between the person who's before the court for the first time and the person who has been before the court before. And so we're trying to kind of capture the concept that's underlying the federal system here and have sanctions based on not just how many counts an indictment contains, and believe me, indictments can contain any number of counts depending on the views of the prosecutor who is preparing the charging instrument. It has no bearing whatsoever necessarily on real-world conduct. And so what this bill tries to do is take the determination of history away from the pleading and formalities of the proceeding to the actual history of the person in dealing with the criminal justice system and whether they learned their lesson or not. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
All right, we're going to take the full panel, then we'll open up for questions.
Can I just interject one thing? Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, with respect to language of our bill as originally written, there is a phrase in here that we would recommend just sort of mentally getting deleted out of here in all three sections. And that's the phrase that says, or could have been joined for trial. So as it reads on lines 5 and 8 and 9 and 13, it says the offender's criminal history may not include crimes that were or could have been joined for trial. We're suggesting for purposes of ease and clarity that we just strike out the phrase could have been joined and just have it read may not include crimes that were joined for trial. That way it's much more easy to simply reference the indictment or reference a past judgment order. You don't have to look behind the judgment order and the official paperwork of the court to determine whether something could have been joined. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Jess Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. Appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. I've actually been working on this legislative concept off and on since 1995. What I've got some written materials I see being passed out right now. What I want to do is give you a presentation that graphically explains how the current law works and how the law would work with respect to each of these three amendments that the bill has. And then as I go through that, also show the cost savings that each of the three amendments could conceivably generate.
I'll do that with this PowerPoint presentation, which
hopefully will work properly. That's so good. Under the current law, what I've done in my written materials, you see I have a hypothetical case where we have a defendant charged with, he's been convicted of four crimes, one level 9 crime and three level 8 crimes. Those are his current crimes of conviction. And then he also has two prior convictions, both of which are non-person felonies. So this is how his sentencing possibilities would stack up now. If you look at your grid and you see, look at criminal history score F, it says two or three adult person felonies, or non-person felonies, adult non-person felonies in the record.
That is what this guy has, two prior non-person felony convictions in his record, so his criminal history score is F on count one. That's his first count that he's going to be sentenced on. And that will say that's the level 9 crime he's been convicted of, so he's in gridlock 9F on that first count. And you can see from your chart that that has a presumptive maximum sentence of 45 months. If the jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt one or more aggravating factors, the court could double the sentence from 45 months to 90 months. Now, that's the way the guidelines would work on count one. On count two, the defendant's criminal history score gets reconstituted. This is from the case State versus Buchholz. And what happens there is, in determining the criminal history score on count two, what happens is you take the guy's two prior non-person felony convictions, those are counted in determining his criminal history score on count two, and then you add to that criminal history his conviction on count one, which is a person felony. Count one is a level 9 crime, and it's going to be a person felony. And if you look at your chart under criminal history score C, it says one person felony plus one or more non-person felonies. That's where that guy's at. So on count two, his grid block is going to be 8C. That's a level 8 crime. His criminal history score is C, which carries a presumptive sentence of 34 months. With one or more valid aggravating factors, sentence can be doubled to 68. Counts three and four, the criminal history score is going to stay the same. Nothing's happened with respect to count two that's going to cause a change in the criminal history scores in counts three and four. So all three of the level 8 crimes are going to be sentenced in grid block 8C, and they're all going to carry the same presumptive and departure maximum sentences. So the presumptive maximum consecutive, CS's consecutive sentence, is 147 months. That string there totals 147. And then the departure maximum is 294. 294 months is the sentence that under the current law this defendant could get. That's the maximum sentence under current law that this defendant could get. The costs are as follows. For the presumptive maximum sentence, that's a little bit hard to read, that red there, but it's $347,000 is the cost of incarceration for the presumptive maximum consecutive sentence. That's using the DOC's estimate of our current stated cost of $77.74 a day. If you multiply 147 times 365 times 7774, you come up with that number. It would cost almost $350,000 to incarcerate this guy for the presumptive maximum consecutive sentence. The departure maximum consecutive sentence is almost $700,000 for this one guy. Now, I want to make a couple of points here. Of these costs, 46% of the costs that you just saw are stemmed directly from the decisions in State versus Buchholz and State versus Miller. Those are 1993 Supreme Court decisions, and from the 1993 legislature's repeal of what was called the single judicial proceeding rule. Subsection 1 of the bill would repeal or would overturn Buchholz. Subsection 3 would overturn Miller, and subsection 2 would reinstate the single judicial proceeding rule. 20% of the cost of that current sentence comes from the Buchholz decision. 7.5% comes from the cost of repealing the single judicial proceeding rule. And almost 18% come from the cost of the Miller decision. And this is the point I really want to emphasize. About 38% of the total cost of incarcerating this one defendant comes from result directly from the decisions in Buchholz and Miller. And this is really important for a couple of reasons. One is, this is a point I like to make with folks, and that's that a lot of criticisms get directed, for example, at Measure 11, at the cost of Measure 11. But in my opinion, the cost of Buchholz and Miller, they were decided the same day, and the cost of those decisions rival the cost of Measure 11. They're probably, after Measure 11, the single most expensive sentencing decision that anybody's ever made in this state. Those cases have probably cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, in incarceration costs since they were issued in 1993. The other point I want to make is, in my written materials, I talk about a staff advisory opinion. I quote from a staff advisory opinion that the former Criminal Justice Council staff issued back in 1991, which stated effectively that the decision in Buchholz is not what the legislature intended in 1989. They did not intend for this reconstitution of criminal history scoring to occur. They intended for whatever a defendant's criminal history score was when he started on count one, that's what his criminal history score would be the whole way across. So Buchholz is not, besides being not what the legislature intended, is also very expensive. It's costing, you know, it actually added perhaps 20% to the cost of guideline sentencing in the state, and like I say, it's probably cost the state something hundreds of millions of dollars since 1993. Section 1 would do as follows. It would, what Section 1 would do is overturn the Buchholz decision. So you can see, remember how in the first example, or the current law example, I showed that the criminal history scores on counts 2 and 3 and 4 would be reconstituted by using count 1 to make the grid blocks on 2, 3, and 4 8C. They would not be reconstituted under subsection 1. The guy's criminal history score would start off at F, and it would stay at F all the way across. So now his presumptive maximum and his departure maximum sentence is dropped down because now he's in grid block 8F rather than 8C on counts 2, 3, and 4, and so the consecutive totals drop down commensurately. We get some savings from this that are substantial. The presumptive maximum sentence under this, the cost of the presumptive maximum sentence under subsection 1 would be just almost a little $276,000 as compared to the current law, which is almost $350,000. So there's a savings on just presumptive sentencing in this particular hypothetical. There's a savings of almost $71,000 in this one case from subsection 1. And then when you look at the departure sentencing, there we have a savings of almost $142,000 from this one case as a result of subsection 1. I also want to point this out really briefly, this concept of this Buchholz principle that's used for criminal history scoring is also used in other areas, and a couple of examples I have are the repeat property offender and the repeat meth offender sentences. Those also use the Buchholz principle to determine whether a person has predicates that'll put them under that sentencing laws. So if this repeal or this overturning of the Buchholz decision were also applied to these other sentencing concepts or these other sentencing schemes, there could be other additional substantial savings and correctional costs. This is what the bill does if you add sections 1 and subsections 1 and 2 together. What happens now is that this defendant has two prior non-person felony convictions when he comes on for sentencing for counts 1, 2, 3, and 4. He had two prior non-person felony convictions, and those are scored separately, and that's what makes him an F. But what we're proposing is through subsection 2 is to say that, well, if your prior convictions from one single proceeding just count as a single conviction. And in the amendments we're going to propose, we're going to further refine that by saying that they count as a single conviction if, in that prior proceeding, you incurred concurrent sentences. If the defendant incurred consecutive sentences, then the prior convictions would be scored separately. But the result of this is that the two prior convictions, that non-person felony convictions the guy came in with, would only count as one prior non-person felony if he got concurrent sentences on those convictions, and it drops his original criminal history score down to G. So he's in gridlock 9G to start off with, and he's going to stay in G all the way across, so his presumptive sentences and his departure sentences all drop down, and we get shorter consecutive sentence totals. And we get these sorts of savings now from adding subsections 1 and 2 together. The total savings come to $97,000 under the presumptive sentence system. And they come to then almost $194,000 if departure sentencing is done. And finally, we get to the whole enchilada, all three subsections of the bill put together. And this hypothetical assumes, again, that the defendant got concurrent sentences for those two prior non-person felony convictions, and it also assumes that his four current crimes also have the same victim. What goes on now is that, or what does not go on now, but what would go on under the amendment of subsection 3 is that The guidelines have something called the have a rule which limit which are intended to limit the total length of consecutive sentences. So I call it the consecutive sentence limitation rule. And that rule has within it three components. The first one is the shift to I rule. The second one is the 200% rule, and the third one is the 400% rule. Under the shift to I rule, the shift to I rule says that when a defendant incurs consecutive sentences that stem from or the consecutive sentences that have a single victim under the terms of this amendment, you use his correct criminal history score only when sentencing the primary offense. The primary offense is the crime with the highest seriousness ranking, which here is count one because it has the highest ranking of 9. So the criminal history score of G would be used on that count. But for all additional offenses sentenced consecutively, the court shifts to score I. So uses Griblack 8I all the way across on counts 2 and 3 and 4. This drops down the
presumptive maximums
substantially on the additional offenses, and that's also true about the departure maximums on the additional offenses. But then the 200% rule also comes into play here. The 200% rule says that the total consecutive presumptive sentence that can be imposed in a case cannot exceed 200% of the presumptive maximum of the primary offense. The presumptive maximum of the primary offense is 40, so 200% of that is 80, so that's all that could be imposed presumptively in this case, or by presumptive sentencing in this case. So the 94-month sentence you see there is actually 14 months longer than the 200% rule allows. The 400% rule just doubles everything. It says that 400% of the presumptive maximum primary offense sets the maximum consecutive departure sentence that can be imposed in the case. 400% of 40 is 160, so the 188-month total is 28 months too long. So adjustments have to be made in sentencing. Then this is what the legislature actually also intended to occur when it first enacted the guidelines back in 1989 for these kind of breaks, these kind of limitations to be put on consecutive sentencing. In the presumptive maximum scheme, the 200% rule, as I mentioned, reduces the total length of the consecutive sentence to 80 from 94 to 80 months, and there's the cost of that, $189,000. So the total cost in presumptive sentencing that this bill would generate for this one case is over $158,000 for one case. And then we get a similar thing go on with departure sentencing. 400% rule reduces the sentence from 188 to 160. And then you get a savings of well over $370,000 and savings of $317,000 for this one case. So the real thing is there, well, what could this bill save the state? And one thing I've learned from working on this bill this session is that although state agencies are capable of estimating the fiscal impact of bills that would add to the prison population, they don't know how, as near as I can make out, they don't know how to estimate the savings of legislation that would reduce the prison population. So it's very difficult at this point to come up with a highly reliable estimate of what this bill would save the state overall. So what I've done is I took this hypothetical case here, got information from the Department of using information from the Department of Corrections, I came up with this formula. I understand that there's currently about 13,600 persons in the Department of Corrections prisons, and about 40% of them are serving guideline sentences only. I mean, they're not serving, in addition, Measure 11 sentences or gun minimums or repeat property offender sentences. They're only serving guideline sentences, about 40%. So that comes to about 5,436 inmates, or what I call true guidelines offenders, in that they're only serving guideline sentences. Let's assume that those true guidelines offenders, only one fourth of them would actually benefit from this bill. Just a fourth of them. And of that one fourth, they would enjoy, I guess, or they would obtain a 10% reduction in their sentences as compared to what our hypothetical guy would have gotten. And then assume that they only have presumptive sentences. I've broken this thing down to the studs as far as I can, and I'm trying to make a very conservative cost savings estimate. Say we'll just take the true Measure 11 offenders, one fourth of them would benefit from the bill to the tune of only 10% of what my hypothetical guy would benefit from, and the savings to the state would be over $21 million. Now, you can see that it's a pretty substantial chunk of money. Let's say that this number here, let's say half of these offenders would benefit from this bill instead of just a fourth of them, then that number, $21 million, doubles. If in addition to that, the savings for the average defendant is 20% of the savings of my hypothetical presumptive sentence guy, so we have half the guys saving 20% of their time, then the $21 million figure you see there quadruples. So that pretty much ends my presentation. Again, this cost savings estimate is really just a very rough estimate, but I'm very confident in saying that this bill would save the state certainly tens of millions of dollars in correctional costs. It's hard to say when those costs will be realized. That's one of the tricky parts of this, how much would be realized in the next biennium and the biennium after, biennium after that. Those kind of calculations should be possible to do those. I'm sure it's possible to do those, but unfortunately, as of now, we don't have the capacity to make those kind of calculations. But we do have some idea here that from this extremely conservative formula I've given you that we can see there, you can see that this bill should save the state millions, tens of millions of dollars, and conceivably hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on how far you want to go with it. And that's the end of my presentation. I'm like the others, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. I'm going to open up the panel for questions. Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand what we're dealing with here. Your hypothetical case, this is a second-time offender. He's already been to prison or county jail once, and this is the second time he's going there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and based on our tour with Department of Corrections and my limited knowledge of this, the repeat offender is pretty high here. So if you let these people out under this proposal you have here, what's the chances of a third-time offender? What are the costs of prosecution from the district attorney? What are the costs of prosecution from the public defender? And how many of these are going back there as a third time anyway because we let them out early?
You know, anything like that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, that's a very good question. And in terms of actually estimating the fiscal savings of this bill, those sort of costs that you just described need to be calculated in. There need to be estimates made of, for example, of this hypothetical defendant, how many of these folks would actually reoffend and would end up back in the system anyway, or in the end anyway. Under this hypothetical, the defendant would serve 80 months. So he's going to get out substantially sooner than he would have without the bill. So some kind of estimate has to be made as well. He's going to get out after 80 months rather than after 216 months or whatever it was. And calculations have to be made that are beyond my capability. I'm not an economist to make those kind of calculations. I could barely come up with the conservative estimate that I did come up with. But I'm going to readily admit that those are costs that have to be used to adjust the $21 million figure, for example, that I just showed you.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In your experience, let's say hypothetically we passed this bill and there was that savings, what programs exist that money should be applied to so that we don't get third-time offenders? Because it only works if you don't get a third-time offender.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Boquist, I think, for example, one thing I've told people about is there's costs involved in funding the treatment facilities or the treatment programs that the voters were told they would get through ballot measure 57, for example. Maybe something along those lines would be a place to put some of the money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Following along with Senator Boquist's line of questioning, I think certainly we'd have to see the potential cost of recidivism calculated to offset that your potential savings. And the other thing that I don't believe that Senator Boquist mentioned was the cost of victimization, which is also needs to be figured into it. Not only the social cost of victimization, but also the actual cost to the victims and to the economy. So it's. I applaud you for your calculating one side of the equation, but we need to see the entire equation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. In follow-up to what Senator Boqvist and Senator Whitsett are saying, I want to point out something about the bill. Sections 1, 2, and 3 are divisible. It may be that the committee doesn't like all three of these sections. So it could be that you might consider under Section 1, the first-time offender before the court for the very first time really is different than someone who has offended previously, served their time, offended again, and is a recidivist, and that would be Section 2. So if you had someone who, for the very first time, got up in some drug problem and then ended up with 5 identity thefts, and it's the very first time in front of the court, then the question might be, would you give them the benefit of this calculation if they were there the very first time? And that would be Section 1. And if you wouldn't be so favorable to do that again later, then you might not be interested in Section 2. But I do point out to the committee that these are divisible concepts. And it would, with respect to the fiscal analysis, for that very first-time offender, affect the bodies that are going through the door into the DOC. Because if you don't reconstitute their criminal history for the 5 counts of conviction before the court the very first time, then they very well may be on probation and in the community on probation. And I would ask Mr. Blackman if he couldn't articulate what the federal system does if, in fact, the way in which they calculate their criminal history doesn't appropriately account for, perhaps, some of the conduct that's occurred in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, as you can tell just from the presentation that Mr. Barton just made, there are lots and lots of moving parts to this whole system. And what we're trying to address here is one of the basic concept of who constitutes a first offender and who constitutes a recidivist. Under the federal system, if you're talking about someone with criminal activity in their past, whether or not it has resulted in convictions and sentences that do or do not get caught up in the calculation of criminal history, there's a rule that allows the court to adjust the criminal history if the formal calculation either results in a number that over-represents the actual history of criminal conduct, or under-represents that history. And I don't think it's our purpose today to go into the details of that, but those are the kinds of rules that can be used to make sure that there is a correlation between the mathematical computation and the reality presented. And I'd just like to echo again what Ms. Meyer just said, which is, under our current system, the number of counts in the indictment drives the determination of criminal history. It has really very little to do with what happened in the world to bring that person before the court. And the person before the court for the first time on a 10-count indictment may in fact have engaged in exactly the same conduct as a person before the court for the first time on a 1-count indictment. And our current system treats the second fellow very leniently, and it treats the first fellow very harshly, and they're the same fellows from all intents and purposes. So I would urge the committee to reflect on what is the purpose of sentencing, and if there's any reformation aspect to it at all, and I think we've all recognized that simply warehousing people ultimately doesn't work if there aren't programs. And when you talk about recidivism rates, I think you also have to look at, have we been helping people while incarcerated to change? And I think if you look at the way the budget's been run for the last few years out of necessity, there are no programs for people who are warehoused. So they come out probably, certainly if they're younger, worse than they went in, because the only people with whom they have association are people who are in prison because they misbehaved. So these cost savings that we're talking about would in fact allow for programming that would affect the recidivism rate. There are lots of moving parts here. But if we believe that people can learn lessons, then one of the things we ought to be doing is treating people who have not had a chance to learn a lesson differently from those who have.
All right. Thank you. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blackman anticipated and answered part of my question, and that had to do with trying to figure out that equation, especially with young people. How do we get around that assumption that leaving them in a little bit longer is going to mean that they're less likely to recidivate? And I know from what we've heard on this committee that, especially with youth, that may not be the case. And so I don't know how we factor that in, but it's something to consider. What I wanted to ask about the other part of my question was there a discernible difference before and after 1993 when the two cases were passed? Just in terms of crime rates of recidivism, were we safer in our communities after these two cases? I'm just trying to figure out, because that seemed to be what really changed things was in 1993. So was there a difference before and after? Because obviously before those cases went into effect, things were done the way that you're proposing to do in the bill.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, I don't know off the top of my head the answer to your question, but I would be very interested in following up on that and
thank
see
you.
If I can find out.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to call up our next panel.
Thank you.
And our next panel is going to be Brad Berry and Walt Bigelow.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. With me is District Attorney Walt Bigelow from Marion County. Our hope here to try and save time and to be as efficient as we could were to deal with different parts of this proposal. I'm going to talk about certain sections, and then District Attorney Bigelow is going to talk about the section which deals with the consecutive sentencing, the 200-400% rule that Mr. Barton mentioned. I've got my notes here, and I'm going to have to be careful because Ms. Meyer said they're excising certain portions of the bill, which I was prepared to comment on, so I may trip on that a little bit, but I'll try and just go to the parts that appear to remain. The bill does, Senate Bill 252 does several things. One, as you know it from the prior discussion, it reverses the Miller-Buchholz decisions in how an offender is treated in a single judicial proceeding, whether he or she moves up the grid for each sentence for a new conviction or whether they stay at the same grid block. It's important for me to note for you here, especially after the comments from Mr. Blackman ending, he talked about indictments driving the sentencing, and that's with all due respect, it's not indictments, it's not charging, it is the convictions that ultimately determine the sentence of the court, not what's charged. And we need to be very careful there, because you could have an indictment with many, many counts and an offender would be convicted, say, of 5 rather than 15. So it really is what the conviction is that we need to deal with. Secondly, Section 2 deals with how we calculate the criminal history score for a subsequent proceeding, not the first proceeding. Again, I want to caution a little bit again on Mr. Blackman's comments that yes, we do have offenders who are there for a first time proceeding with multiple offenses, but oftentimes we're dealing with folks who have come before the court a second, third, or fourth time and now have multiple offenses for what they're charged. And again, Mr. Bigelow will talk about Section 3 there. This bill would radically change the potential way that a prolific criminal is treated by the court system. In simple terms, it's important to note that it treats similar defendants very differently. And excuse me, as we talk about the sentencing guidelines, unfortunately, I've been doing this a long time now. I remember when the guidelines came into effect, and one of the principal things that the guidelines sought to do was to ensure that we treat similar defendants, similar conduct with similar backgrounds, similarly. And I'll show you in a moment how this would radically change that for someone charged in a particular crime spree. Allow me to give you an example, and I actually have the indictment sitting here with me. This is out of a Curry County case, but this is not an uncommon thing that we deal with frequently. A 40-year-old man is charged with having sexual intercourse with two victim girls. One is 14 years of age, and the second is 15 years of age. The particular case that I'm drawing this from, he also plied them with alcohol and marijuana. I'm going to put that aside just for the sake of this illustration. The offenses all come to light at the same time, and he's charged with having sex with each of them on four different occasions for a total of 8 counts of rape in the third degree. If you look at your grid, you'll note that rape 3 is a Category 6 offense. And let's assume for the purpose of this discussion that this man has never been before the court before. So he begins as an I. Now, here, what would happen, let's say he's convicted of four, ultimately half of the charges, 2 counts of rape 3 against each of these victims. He would move from a grid block I, the second offense would be D, the third offense would be B, and the fourth offense would be an A under the current sentencing structure that we have. The proposal of Senate Bill 252 would actually have him serve a presumptive probation sentence for having been convicted of all 4 counts. In fact, if he's convicted of all 8 counts, the presumptive sentence would be probation for it. So 8 separate incidents of having sexual relations with these girls, and he would be presumptive probation if convicted of all 8, as Senate Bill 252 would have. The other problem with this is that we're talking about having dealt with in a single proceeding. So let's take the same fellow who is charged in Coos County, and let's move him to the Portland area. If, in fact, then, he picked up one of these girls and had sexual relations with her in Hillsborough, and the next time went and had sexual relations with her in Portland, and the next time in West Lynn, and the next time in St. Paul, that person then, under 252, would be treated as an I, D, B, A on the grid. However, if those 4 incidents all occurred in my county, in Yamhill County, and were brought at the same time, he would be an I on the grid for all 4 counts. In other words, because you can't bring those cases from a different county into my county, for example, they would be treated as separate offenses that could not be joined for trial. And we treat that defendant, who had sexual relations with a girl 4 times, significantly different than we would treat him if he had sexual relations with that same girl over the same period of time in a single county. In other words, we take a similarly situated defendant with the same conduct with radically different potential sentences. Now, the difficulty with establishing prior criminal records that is set forth in Section 2 of the bill and setting forth the prior is somewhat taken care of by the proposal that Ms. Meyer said, by taking out the "or could have been charged." However, it would still require the state in those multiple previous convictions to determine whether or not they all came out of a single proceeding. You can have separate proceedings which can occur on the same date. You can have separate proceedings that dealt with different types of offenses. Do we have the same victim? Do we have multiple victims? Currently, for consistency's sake, we look at the prior criminal convictions, we can calculate what it is on the criminal history score, and everybody knows what we're playing with. Rather than have to have hearings, for example, determine before the court what is the prior criminal history, this particular bill would cause more of those hearings to occur. It rarely occurs today. And I do want to remind you that leaving in the language "or could have been" would create a monster for litigation for us at the trial court level in determining prior criminal histories. And again, I think the OCDLA approach to remove that is a wise position there. If this is an effort, this basically is an effort to reduce sentences on the repeat offender. In other words, it is a quantity discount for those offenders who come before the court with multiple offenses and they get caught all at once. The person who is a serial burglar, for example, comes in and they're caught and they're charged with burglarizing 5 houses all at once. They get a quantity discount under Senate Bill 252, which should not occur. The Miller-Buchholz decisions recognize that, in fact, we do treat someone differently who has repeatedly broken the law, even though we're in a single proceeding, than someone who has not. It does, the current law allows the court discretion, for example, with consecutive versus concurrent sentences. The court has a lot of latitude in determining, and when you look at the maximum potential sentences that Mr. Barton talked about, we seldom reach those in these cases because it would require the court to impose the maximum on each count and consecutive. We don't want to be in a position of giving repeat offenders this quantity discount that I mentioned before. If we're going to have a discussion about sentencing and appropriate sentences, and I think Senator Bonamici's comments go to that, how much time is the appropriate amount of time? Those are policy decisions we should have. But I think it gets away, Senate Bill 252 gets away from good policy discussions of how much time is the appropriate amount of time. And what we're really arguing about in principle, I didn't hear much of a statement saying that these sentences are inappropriate for the conduct. It's checkbook justice in that we save potentially a lot of money by non-incarcerating somebody as long. There's no debate that that's accurate. We save money by non-incarcerating people. But the other part is, what system cost is there to re-prosecuting, additional victimization, and court costs? Thank you.
Walt? Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Walt Becklaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I support Mr. Berry and his comments. Specifically, though, I think Senate Bill 252 will fundamentally undermine the statutory, the judicial interpretation, and even the constitutional merits of consecutive sentencing under Oregon law. Even a generous reading, and I have looked at this very closely, Section 3 of 252 would lead me to conclude that the intent is to eviscerate the court's inherent authority to sentence a defendant consecutively for multiple acts against a single victim, whether or not those acts derive from the same criminal episode during the same act or transaction, or in essence, acts that span a period of time. And these are the cases where we see children being sexually abused over years of periods of time. And frankly, when you look at the express language of Section 3, I believe it runs headlong into the constitutional requirements of Article 1, Section 44.1b of the Oregon Constitution, that no law shall limit a court's authority to sentence a defendant consecutively for crimes against different victims. And potentially, abridgment of ballot Measure 11 sentencing by capping, as we have discussed, the minimums through the 200% rule on consecutive for presumptive sentences, and the 400% rule that applies after you do the 200% rule for departures. I urge the committee to look clearly. Senate Bill 252 states that any limitations of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission rules or future rules established by the commission will apply to consecutive sentencing for all cases that were joined under the liberal joinder statutes and or could have been joined and subsequently sentenced in a single proceeding, period. This abandons a very long-standing Supreme Court interpretation of the relationship that sentencing guidelines has with ballot Measure 11 and other sentencing provisions, the OARs, and the superseding provisions of Measure 11, 3488. And frankly, I think it serves quite openly to grant a free pass, in my opinion, to insulate those who choose to commit violent multiple crimes against the same or potentially separate victims who are charged and then handled in one court proceedings. Really, if you look at the consecutive sentencing statutes, at its core is a measurement of harm to victims and an accounting for the scope of the defendant's behavior vested with the court's discretion in ORS 137.123. This is the template that courts use to find an equitable sentencing decision in each particular case. And likely, it's probably one of the most important public safety tools that Oregon has in making the right call on this particular offender in front of the court. And essentially, regardless of those findings that they can, or the rules that the Criminal Justice Commission could apply in the future to those, would undermine our ability to utilize those interrelated statutes And as I can read all the cases here, Langdon, Miller Buchholz, Young on 3488, recency will control. So I think that language is extremely detrimental. So it's really a question of, are we going to leave it up when it comes to consecutive sentencing to the Criminal Justice Sentencing Commission to define the propriety of sentence, or are we going to let it up, leave it to the court like it has been for generations, from the original Criminal Code 1971? And frankly, I think we should have that authority in the courts to capture those victims. You know,
I need you to summarize.
I'm going to summarize now. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The heart of sentencing is a local decision. In terms of reality and real-world conduct, there are frightening things happening to families. What we handle are the violent cases against children that span years of time, kidnaps, rapings, and burglaries that stem from one uninterrupted course of conduct, murders of children that have prior criminal mistreatments against those and other children, and these are distinct from the vision of federal sentencing. So I guess my final comment would be is that a justice system that ebbs and flows with an argument on resources is really not much of a justice system at all when it comes to accountability at a local level. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment and then a question. I did the calculation, and I won't even go into the details, but I don't see any savings in sub 2, sub 3. Much of the logic there, but section 1-1, gentlemen, if you look at that, is there a means, given the fact that we have so many repeat offenders, what can we do up front with those first-time offenders, you know, reduce the sentence, put them into treatment? What do we do to keep them from being second-time offenders? Once they hit that paragraph 2 there, it's all over as far as I see, and there is no savings. Savings is totally wiped out by district attorney, public defender offices, everything else like that. But what do we do up front? I mean, Senator Bonamici made mention, do we segregate these first-time offenders? Do we put them someplace else? How do we fix the system beyond you? Once they're convicted, there's a problem. We all know there's a problem. Any ideas?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, if I might, and maybe I should get away from my hat of ODAA and just speak from my experience in the trenches. I think we do deal with most people who come before the court as a first offender differently than those people who come back before the court. We already do that. And other than when we talk about violent person felonies, many of those are encompassed in Measure 11 and involve prison time right up front. But most of the offenders we deal with who are property offenders or drug offenders, the vast majority of those who come before us for the first time are dealt with in probationary sentences and ordered in, at least in my court, ordered into treatment, because many of them have drug problems or other substance abuse problems. So I think the system does routinely and consistently deal with the first offender differently than we do. And I would say that's, I'm talking, in fact, the first-time adult offender, even those who have juvenile records. Oftentimes, once they've come into, as we kiddingly call it, big boys court, as an adult, we typically still deal with them. This is their first time in the adult system, and we continue to deal with them differently than the recidivist.
Follow up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So I guess the point is, what do we need to do better? Because, as your colleague next to you said, we have limited resources, we have this problem in front of us, we have all these repeat offenders. We got to do something better with the first-time offender to rehabilitate them. And is that, do we put more money into treatment? What do we address that so that 2 and 3 get solved by not repeating the offense?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, I, and I believe most of my colleagues, are pretty firm believers in that treatment must be a component of sentencing for many individuals. Some pose such a significant risk to our communities that they need to be locked up. Candidly, we err on the side of public safety in the future to trying to fix somebody. But the vast majority that we see for these first offenders are ordered into treatment. And one of the problems, I think, one of the real trade-offs that we have to deal with here, that you have to deal with, is when we're trying to save money, do we save money from incarceration costs? Do we save money from treatment? What do we do? I think 95% of the offenders put into prison are going to come back. And if they don't have treatment at some point to deal with either substance abuse or cognitive issues that they have, criminal thinking, then in fact they come out the same or worse than they went in. But I don't want to kid you to say that we don't at some point err on the side of, I know while you're in prison or while you're in jail, you will not be offending against my community. Because some of these folks who do come back over and over, at some point we err on that side. We're done trying to fix you. You need to fix yourself. I need to protect my community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My last panel that I have scheduled for here includes Ben Unger, Michael Slawson, and Doug Barkrode. And Ben, as you're coming up, are you doing just intro?
I am, sir.
All right, I'm going to ask you not to do intro because I'm running late on time. I think Michael can take care of himself. Doug, if you'll come on up. Ben, thank you.
Chairman Zonsky, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slawson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm in the Criminal Justice Division. I'm here to testify in opposition on behalf of the Attorney General John Kroger to Senate Bill 252. The Attorney General would echo the concerns raised by the district attorneys. I want to address a few issues that have not since been addressed before the committee today. A bit on the history of these cases. The cases in State versus Miller and State versus Buchholz, in those cases, the Oregon Supreme Court actually interpreted what the legislature intended to do in 1989, not creating a different rule of law or diverting from what the sentencing guidelines manual was. They're doing their best to figure out what did the legislature intend in 1989. Just to clarify, one other point on the record is that you mentioned that we're sort of reverting back to 1989. That's what Miller and Buchholz were doing. The single judicial proceeding rule was in full effect during the Merrill Buchholz opinions. That rule applied. It just wasn't applicable to the facts of those cases. So the way the law works right now is that if you have a person who is engaged in a single criminal episode, so an example of that would be like maybe a sex abuse case where you have multiple offenses are committed against one victim in one incident. When you go to sentencing on that person, each offense that is sentenced is not calculated against that person's criminal history. That rule still exists. That's still the way it works here. And the reason for that is because you look at it and you want to treat the offender based on a single behavioral pattern. So you look at the offense and it's a series of offenses all together in one incident. And for sentencing purposes, you want to treat that as one incident, or that's what the legislative policy was back in 1989. What this does is something completely different, and it ties sentencing, your sentencing policies, to whether or not cases could have been consolidated for trial, which of course raises a whole different set of policy considerations about whether or not you want to consolidate a case for trial. For instance, mostly judicial resources, or perhaps not wanting a victim to testify multiple times. There's just different policy reasons for that. And I just want to touch just briefly on how you can consolidate cases for trial. One of them is if it's a single criminal episode, because that's a constitutional requirement. But the one I want to focus on, just to be brief, is same or similar conduct. You can consolidate criminal trials based on same or similar conduct. So what I'd like to just point out for the committee, how broadly that reaches, how far off you can go with same or similar conduct to consolidate cases. I point the committee's attention to State versus Meyer. In that case, the court held that the defendant's two DUIs and three driving while suspended offenses spanning more than 4 years were sufficiently similar to be joined. In another case, State versus Rude, we held that charges of sodomy, sex abuse, and endangering the welfare of a minor involving different victims were of a similar character because each charge alleged sexual conduct by the defendant toward male children he had brought to his home for purposes of adoption. So what you're really considering here by tying the ability to consolidate criminal trials to sentencing is getting one conviction for purpose of criminal history up to, in this case, in the Meyer case, over a four-year time span and multiple different offenses, multiple different criminal episodes. So what you end up with sort of this arbitrary sentencing policy. In one case that I actually handled on appeal, I want to just briefly...
Michael, you need to finish up because I've got Mr. Harper Road and I've got five more cases that
okay.
I think set for today.
So here's the rub. The reason why this is arbitrary is because to be similar characters, say you've got a sex offense case, they all are females under the age of 13. That person gets one sentence. The person offends against three other victims, but one of them has to be an adult female, gets a different sentence. That's completely arbitrary.
All right. Thank you very much for wrapping up. Doug?
Doug Harkelrode, retired Lane County District Attorney and currently representing the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. We oppose this bill. This is the Walmart or Costco of criminal justice. It's the quantity discount that for repeat offenders that Mr. Berry mentioned. So, if you would please, I'm going to do this quickly and eliminate most of what I had to say. Grab your 2008 sentencing guideline grid. There are, by the way, I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon. I've been teaching sentencing guidelines there for a long time, and I'm going to do this really quick. There are two things that are key to sentencing guidelines. The vertical column is 1 through 11. 1 is the least serious crime serious. 11 is the most serious. Then across the top, you go from I to A. I is the least serious criminal conduct in the past. A is the most serious. Okay? Those two axes make the difference. We used to have pre-sentence reports so that the judges could figure out what to do with offenders. When we got this grid, we didn't need them anymore because they're sitting right here, although I'd suggest it would be a better deal to have pre-sentence reports. Okay, so, real live story. James Parker Williams, indicted March 17, 2009 for behavior for assaulting Raylee Jean Hammer. Many times, 10 counts on the indictment. He's pleading to 5 of those counts. I picked this case up. This is a real life case. I went down to the Wayne County DA's office on Friday and said, hey, give me some buckholes cases. Boom, they got a bunch of them. Okay, so he has a prior conviction for beating up Raylene. That makes him a felon, although it's assault for simple physical injury. Because he's done it to her before, he's a felon. Look on the column on the left-hand side, half a dozen or so down for assault 4. That's the way you use this grid. Crime seriousness and all, can you find assault 4? I'm looking for head nods.
Got it.
Yeah, okay. That's a category 6. By the way, red is person crimes, blue is property crimes, black is the rest of the stuff, and we won't worry about drugs today. All right. It's a Category 6. So please run up the vertical axis on the to 6. Everybody there? It's the black column running up to 6. I got a few head nods, but I don't have everybody's head. Okay. Now, because he has one prior conviction, he is an H. Look at the top column there. He's H. If you turn it sideways, you see no more than 3 adult A mistos. He has 1 adult A misto. It's assault 4 for beating her up before. So he is a 6H. If you run down to the grid block, you see that he gets 180 over 90 days. Now those are sanction units is 180. I'm not going to bother with that today. 90 is the jail units. There is a one-third rule, so he only gets 30 days in jail. And if you move to the right, see the column that says probation duration? You see 3 years there? Everybody with me? I know I'm going fast. So he's going to get 3 years of probation and 30 days in jail for that assault for felony. Now, because he's charged in all one indictment, if you do not so-called buckholz him, that's the same sentence he's going to get the next time he assaulted her and was convicted, and the next time he assaulted her and was convicted, all in one indictment because they're all grouped together. If you buckholz him, and I'm not going to take you through the grid stuff here, but you get how this grid works. You're going to move over, basically, to the left when you look at the grid. The next time he gets sentenced, he's doing 13 to 14 months because he's now a 6D. Oh, actually, yeah, there we go, 13 to 14 months. Yeah, 6D. And the next time, because he did it a third time, he beat her up in the presence of a child, he's going to 7B. I'd suggest to you that's exactly what he deserves, and the state is dismissing 5 other counts. Now, I've got another example. I'm not going to go through it, but I know you folks are concerned about metal theft. In Lane County, this guy stole metal 3 different times. He absconded so many times we couldn't get him in front of the court. he would get presumptive probation for a $10,000 metal theft, at least a $1,000 metal theft, and a $30,000 metal theft, and he would not go to prison under this Senate Bill 252. But under Buchholz, he's going to prison. All right. That's a real summary. Now, I have just a couple quick comments.
Very quick.
Warehousing does work. Putting people in prison does work. There's a Forbes article on it. Your own Criminal Justice Commission says it works. It does work. Now, warehousing has a bad term. Incarceration does work in terms of lowering recidivism rate, having crime, less crime. It's not the solution. Senator Boquist asked about treatment. Treatment works for some people some of the time. Picking the right ones is the critical factor, and evaluating the program to see if it actually works, because there's a ton of programs that have no effect. The DARE program has basically no effect, according to the studies. Mr. Taylor gave me an article on Washington. They reviewed 500 or 300 some programs. It does work. The final thing is, Mr. Berry addressed this, and I'd like to mention it too. Most felons are put on probation. They are not sent to the penitentiary, at least initially. So our probation penitentiary mix is about 2/3 on probation and 1/3 in the penitentiary, roughly. And we need to deal with those 2/3 that are on probation through whatever programs we can get them to change their criminal thinking and to deal with their drug and alcohol problems. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 252? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we're going to close the public hearing on 252. And counsel, where do we want to go from here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have Senate Bill 670 in front of us, which we have the dash two amendments on. We have the fiscal and revenue, I believe. I think we do. At least I have the revenue.
Yes.
We do. And the dash two amendments add audiologists and speech language pathologists to the list of those professions that it must report elderly abuse. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Senator Winters. We had a hearing on the bill on 4/13.
All right. I'm going to open up work session on Senate Bill 670.
Mr. Chair, move the dash 2 into 670.
Senator Boquist moves the dash 2s into Senate Bill 670. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move SB 670 to the floor with a due pass as amended by the dash 1, noting that the fiscal is only $2,800.
Dash 2s.
All right. Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 670 as amended by the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Winters will be our carrier. And as a backup, let's see this one here. Dingfelder will be our backup if Senator Winters does not care to carry it. And we'll close that work session. And counsel, do you have anything else?
Chairman of the committee, we have several of the bills on. We do not have the amendments on Senate Bill 309. We have a hearing on it, but no one signed up to testify. As you know, we have amendments to this bill that will significantly change what the bill does. And those changes relate to Senate Bill 253 and Senate Bill 289. So we probably have to wait as far as those issues until we get the amendments.
All right. What I'm going to do is first, just technically, I'm going to open up a public hearing for Senate Bill 309. Is anyone here that wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 309? Not seeing anyone come forward. We'll close the public hearing on 309. And what we're going to do is we're going to carry over Senate Bill 309, Senate Bill 253, and Senate Bill 289 until tomorrow, Tuesday, the 21st. All right. Then we have Senate Bill 310.
Correct.
My understanding, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on 310. I understand that we do not have the paperwork that's necessary for
it. Members of the committee, we just got the dash 4 amendments literally 15 minutes before this meeting started.
All right, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 310 until Wednesday, which will be the 22nd, and we'll see if we got the fiscals catching up with the dash 4s. And then we have, I think the other two were Audubon's?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, and
Ms. Braun, which of these two, if either of them, are ready to go?
They're both ready to go, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's start with Senate Bill 306. We'll open up a work session on 306 and give us a review.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 306 was in front of the committee last Friday. It's the bill that increases the demand limit for small tort action. And we have a -6 and a -7 amendment. We had a revised fiscal over the weekend on the -7 amendment that should have been on your desk. And basically, it says the fiscal was revised because LFO received more information. It's still indeterminate, but it's saying they can't tell whether it increased costs or decreased costs. It's kind of a wash on the -7.
Okay. So we have a work session open on Senate Bill 307, and the chair will take an amendment.
On which one?
The six and the seven.
Well, no, this
no,
one or the other.
The -7 is the one that incorporates. The -7 amendment has the contract language in it and covers contract, small contract actions as well. The -6 only covers small torts.
So my understanding, the sevens is what is preferred from the people I've spoken with, but maybe not everyone here at the dais.
Mr. Chair, I prefer the six. But
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -7 amendment.
Why don't you go for the seven so we can just move through this and see where we're at.
I move the -7 amendment to the Senate Bill 306.
All right, Senator Bonamici moves the -7s into Senate Bill 306. I'm opening it up for discussion, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I just prefer the six over the seven, and I'll have to think about it a little bit, but I might vote two ways, one in the committee and a different on the floor.
Okay. Senator Wissett?
Yeah, I was John Powell's letter here, and with the sevens, I'll be a no on this one. I might be a no on the six, too, but definitely with a seven.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I brought the -7 amendment forward because I had a proposed bill that would have made the same change to the contract portion of the statute. It's consistent if we're changing the tort section of the statute to also change the contract section of the statute. And there was a compromise given that involves a provision of records on an ongoing basis during the negotiations that I think was a good compromise on and it carries forward on both the tort and the contract provisions.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
My concern is with the contract language is that I'm not sure that it seems to me that it opens up the private course of private action in addition to, say, if you were to buy an appliance at Lowe's, just and then you were dissatisfied with it. Not only would you have, you wouldn't have to go necessarily through the negotiation, the mediation in court through the seller and the buyer, but you also might, I'm not an attorney, but it certainly looks to me like it opens up a venue for action outside of that, and I'm really uncomfortable with that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I'll be able to vote on, but I'll get together with Senator Bonamici and others between now and the floor and try and better understand it.
All right. So if there's no other discussion, let's go ahead, and on this one here, it sounds like we have some no votes. Let's go ahead and do a vote by call.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Dean Calder?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
No.
Vice Chair Boquist?
No.
Chair Pazenski?
Aye. We have enough votes to pass the measure to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended by, that's the -7.
That's the -7.
Being amended.
Are you ready for
yes.
Senate Bill 306 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves the Senate Bill 306 as amended by the -7s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? All right, let's do a roll call just for this one.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Dean Calder?
Aye.
Senator Whitsett?
No.
Vice Chair Boquist?
No.
Chair Pazenski?
Chair votes aye with sufficient votes to take it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Bonamici will be our carrier.
and we'll close the record session on that. I'm going to go ahead and open up the last work session that we have scheduled for today on Senate Bill 274.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 274 is the Office of Administrative Hearings Bill. We heard this on March 19th. It was also in front of us on Friday, but we didn't have enough time to get to it. We didn't have the fiscal statement, and now we do. And it's also indeterminate fiscal. There's the Dash 4 and the Dash 5 amendments. The difference between those is the Dash 5 is the Secretary of State's office is not required to use the Office of Administrative Hearings in the Dash 5 amendments. So the Dash 4 amendment has the Secretary of State in it.
All right. The Chair will entertain a motion on the Dash 4s. And I think that's Senator Wissett.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment into 274.
Boquist moves the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 274. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the Dash 4 is the one that includes the Secretary of State's office under the Office of Administrative Hearings?
Yes.
Excuse me. I actually have struggled with this one a bit, having reviewed the original language of the statute when the Office of Administrative Hearings was created, and don't see a distinction between the Secretary of State's office, one of the constitutional offices, and the other offices, the other 27 or 29 that aren't included. I'm still puzzled with why one was singled out as to be brought under the Office of Administrative Hearings as opposed to left out as it was originally when the bill was negotiated. I'm also not convinced that the fiscal impact, and I'm trying to read this quickly because I just got it this morning, I'm not quite sure that, I know that the Secretary of State submitted testimony that they actually spend less money using independent office. I understand that your desire is to move this particular amendment. There's a lot of other things I like about the bill. There's some things I don't like about the bill. Overall, I'll support the bill, but just I would prefer the Dash 5 amendments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dingfelder.
I'm just going to say ditto because Senator Bonamici expressed almost identically the concerns that I have, and that's my preference as well.
I'm with the Dash 4, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions, discussion? All right. Any objections to the adoption of the Dash 4s? All right. I just want to make sure we have, let's do roll call because I'm not getting.
Senator Bonamici?
No.
Senator Dingfelder?
No.
Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Bozowski?
Chair votes aye.
The Dash 4s are adopted.
Does that go downstairs? I see fiscal.
My understanding it does not, or does it?
Well, at this point, we don't know yet. That will be a decision for the President's office. I tried to give a call and find out what they would be deciding on that, but I haven't found out.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 274 with the Dash 4 to the floor with a due pass pending a decision by the President's office for referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Boquist moves the Senate Bill 274 as amended by the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation subject to a referral by the President to Ways and Means if he determines that necessary. Any discussion? Any objection?
Sorry.
Senator Bonamici. I'm looking around.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I explained, there are some things I like about this bill and some things I don't. And I am going to support the bill, but I wanted to make a couple of comments and then ask for a clarification on one particular issue. The comments that I make have to do with the changing of this, the burden from, excuse me, and I can't remember what section it's in, but changing the burden of from preponderance to clear and convincing. I guess that's in Section 8. I understand we've had a lot of discussions about this, and I understand the intent in doing that. I'm just not sure that it's it's addressing the problem that people perceive. From what I've looked at in the decisions that have been provided to me, both as a member of this committee and as a member of the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee, I don't believe that the problem is changing historical facts. I think it's much more complex than that. The handful of cases where there has been a change by the agency from the administrative law judge, it's not completely clear that it's historical facts that are the issue. And so I think we may be creating a situation where we end up with a lot of disputes about what's a historical fact and what isn't a historical fact. So that's my concern about that section. I completely support the change of appointment of the Chief Administrative Law Judge and other provisions of the bill. I would like some clarification from the bill's proponents about the intent of taking out the language in Section 5 where it says the Office of Administrative Hearings is established within the Employment Department, and within the Employment Department is taken out, and then additional language is added in Section 5, Paragraph 3 about the Employment Department providing office space, hearing rooms, and administrative support services. I just want to clarify the intent because there's an established relationship between the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Employment Department, and I'm just trying to figure out for the record and for the purposes of the Oversight Division, and purposes of the department, what the intent is in changing that language. Is it changing the relationship? Is it more of an, is there oversight by the Employment Department over the OA Office of Administrative Hearings? Is it just ministerial? Is it changing, how is it changing the relationship? So if I could just get that clarification on the record from the proponents of the bill, I think it would be helpful.
All right. Chair will try to respond. The purpose of Section 10 is to make clear that the administrative law judge, chief judge, as well as the Office of Administrative Hearings is not to be, interfered with their work as hearings officers / judges in the work they do, and that they should be independent for that particular purpose. It is understood and expected that they will still be housed at the Employment Department, and that the department will in fact maintain oversight and a billing process for the space that's given to them and all of the administrative costs that's required for that. They are not, meaning the Office of Administrative Hearings is not becoming a independent agency. It is still within the bounds of what is required as to the oversight the department has for controlling and being reimbursed for those expenses for space and going through the process that's required for state agencies. But they are not, basically, that's why we have the chief judge moving out from being through an hiring process of the department and one to appointment by the governor. Yes.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, as you know, I have a pending case of this. You have it on file. Legal counsel tells me I don't have a conflict of interest, but just in case, I want it on the record.
All right. Noted. Any other questions, comments? All right. And the last part on this is the reason that I was part of the negotiations with Senator Wissett as to what the original 274 had requested, and the purpose of having the Secretary of State's office go into the hearings officers is that of the three constitutional offices, from my understanding, it is the only one that has administrative hearings that take place. The governor's office, as well as the treasurer's office, from the reports that we have, do not have administrative hearings, even though they could have administrative hearings. And we know that the Secretary of State's office does, in fact, not only have administrative hearings, but it's very broadly across the board for many, many individuals. And it's my preference and that they act and operate under the administrative law rules that are adopted for the other agencies, commissions, and boards that are, in fact, within the Office of Administrative Hearings jurisdiction.
and instead of having their own set of the separate set of administrative rules that are applied to those that are not within the office administrative hearings. I personally believe it gives an individual that comes in for a contested case more balance in the process than the other. Anything else? All right, so let's take a roll call vote on this one too, please.
Senator Mike Easley?
Aye.
Senator Dean Felder? Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Pelosi?
Aye. Floor passes to the floor, and Senator Whitsitt and I will co-carry the bill. All right, councils, anything else we need to do today? All right, we're back here tomorrow at 8:30. I think we're scheduled for Wednesday at 8:30. Or did we get a post? At 9, excuse me, 9? No, we moved to 8:30. And then just for everyone, Thursday and Friday at this point, we are tentatively scheduled for 8. I want to have the flexibility for the extra 30 minutes, depending on what happens between now and then as carryovers continue. All right, thank you all very much for staying over. We're adjourned.